will be Amy Bradshaw. Amy is a Master in Social Work recipient and a research assistant with Grants Research Planning and Evaluation Unit at the Richmond Behavioral Health Authority. There, she is involved in the agency's program evaluation efforts, research initiatives, and grant writing and grant management activities. Amy received her MSW with a concentration in macro social work practice, policy, and administration from the Virginia Commonwealth University. So Amy's going to talk about social connectiveness and recovery. Do different types of social connectiveness affect substance use disorders recovery outcomes among consumers receiving services in a recovery-oriented system of care approach in a community-based urban setting? Amy?
Good morning. Well, I'm pleased to be here representing the Richmond Behavioral Health Authority. And so I'm going to present some of our findings from an internal program evaluation of the Three Pillars Project, which was generously funded through SAMHSA and housed within our Substance Abuse Division. And specifically, I'm going to talk about some of the findings we discovered related to social connectedness and different types of social connectedness services through that project. So I have no present disclosures. Are no relationships to disclose. So I'm going to start by just a brief introduction to the Richmond Behavioral Health Authority, and you'll hear me refer to that as the RBHA, and then talk a little bit about our Three Pillars Project and some of the services that were offered through that, as well as our Substance Use Division and some of the services we provide, the treatment services we provide. And then just briefly talk about how we work within a recovery-oriented system of care, as well as just some general information about the social connectedness and what that means for recovery. And then I'll talk briefly about our evaluation tools and an overview of what we did, and then just go into some of our findings and then discuss some of our evaluation limitations and some of our future efforts. So the Richmond Behavioral Health Authority is the statutorily established local authority responsible for providing mental health, intellectual disability, substance use disorders, emergency and prevention services for the city of Richmond and Virginia. Last year we served approximately 5% of Richmond's population, which is about 11,000 individuals. So we have a lot going on any given day. Specifically, our Substance Use Disorders Division provides directly operated and contracted services. So some of the directly operated services we provide include case management, treatment referral, interim and follow-up services, motivational enhancement therapy and intensive outpatient services, jail-based, probation, parole-based, and drug court services, and as well as peer recovery support services. And then we contract with some community providers to provide residential medical detox services, outpatient treatment services, outpatient opioid treatment services, as well as residential rehabilitation. So the Three Pillars Project was funded through SAMHSA, and it lasted from 2007 to 2011. And our target population was individuals affected by co-occurring epidemics of substance use disorder and HIV/AIDS in high-risk, high-priority minority communities. Services that were provided through the Three Pillars Project included small group education about the risks and nature of substance use disorders and HIV, rapid HIV testing with pre- and post-test counseling, STD treatment, primary health care evaluation and referral for specialized medical services, and then continuous wraparound supports with follow-up care services. And just to briefly share the project goals were to provide expedited STD screening and assessment services, rapid HIV testing, access to STD treatment and necessary follow-up care services for a minimum duration of 18 months, to increase positive health-maintaining behaviors and reduce specific risk behaviors related to STDs and HIV, and to increase the number of target group members who receive intensive HIV/AIDS prevention education and outreach, as well as expand and enhance partnerships with community agencies and organizations to better access, identify, and serve members of the target population. So just to briefly touch on a recovery-oriented system of care, RBHA does provide treatment, follow-up, and recovery support services that are influenced and in support of a recovery-oriented system of care. This includes collaborations with community organizations that promote and support recovery to help build a network of support services in our community. And SAMHSA defines a recovery-oriented system of care as supporting a person-centered approach that builds on the strengths of individuals, families, and communities to take responsibility for their wellness and recovery from addiction, This includes the provision of continuing care following treatment, education about self-care, regular checkups, and linkages to community resources. Providing the opportunity to develop and maintain social supports is also a part of a recovery-oriented system of care. So studies have shown that an individual's social network and support system can impact their recovery. It's also an important in engagement and retention in substance use disorder treatment services as well as HIV treatment adherence. And a recovery community's culture, including access to programs, support groups, and opportunities to connect with others, is vital to recovery from a substance use disorder. So our evaluation goals for the Three Pillars program were to understand the utilization and impact of different types of recovery support groups at intake in 6 months, and to understand the impact of self-reported social connectedness and interaction with family and friends at intake in 6 months. And we collected data from clients at intake, at 6 months post-intake, and at discharge using the GIPRA evaluation tool. The GIPRA evaluation tool is a self-reported structured interview tool which is developed by SAMHSA and is a mandatory reporting tool for anyone receiving federal SUD treatment funding. And like I said, this is administered to clients at these three time points. Questions on the GIPRA are obtained from previously established data collection instruments, including the Addiction Severity Index, the McKinney Homeless Program Reporting System, the AIDS Risk Assessment, and the Short Form 36 Health Survey. So just to give you an idea of the demographics of participants in the Three Pillars Project, most participants were between the ages of 35 to 45 years. Almost 90% of participants were African American, and less than 10% were white, and over 70% of the participants were male. Additionally, almost 80% of participants reported being unemployed at intake, and this included individuals who were looking for work, were not looking for work, and were on disability. And about 50% had completed some high school, but only about 40% had graduated or received their GED. So we did see an increase across all types of self-help group participation from intake to 6 months. And the categories of types of group you see here are defined by the GIPRA, non-faith-based, faith-based, and faith-based is defined as a group that's run by a religious organization or has a religious or faith-based message for recovery, and other. The other category records whether the client has attended any meetings or activity that's supportive of recovery, even if that's not their direct mission. So we saw the highest level of increase in non-faith-based groups. Some of the reasons we think this might be the case is that GIPRA includes AA and NA groups in this category, and we do have a lot of participants that are attending those groups in addition to RBHA groups. As well, despite the fact that we do ask clients not to include their participation as RBHA when they respond to this, often they will, and so this participation in our groups, our outpatient groups, and just coming to RBHA and participating in any kind of treatment group there is sometimes collected with other or non-faith-based, so that could kind of skew the results there. So we did see a slight decrease in the areas of social connectedness and interactions with family or friends that were in support of recovery, but this was not a significant difference between intake and 6 months. We also looked at participants' attendance at self-help groups based on self-report of substance use on the GIPRA intake, and we saw that those reporting no substance use did have a higher attendance at self-help groups than those reporting use both at intake and at 6 months. So then looking at the GIPRA social connectedness domain, which includes questions related to self-help group participation as well as interactions with family and friends that are supportive of recovery, we saw no significant differences in self-reported anxiety, depression, or violent behavior at follow-up, but we did see a significant difference in self-reported depression at intake, with individual screening positive for social connectedness, reporting less depression than those who were not socially connected, but we didn't see any other significant differences here. In addition, we saw no significant correlations between self-reported attendance in self-help groups and days of alcohol use or days of legal drug use, and no significant differences in self-reported attendance in self-help groups across age, gender, or race at intake or follow-up. So just some of the strengths and limitations of our evaluation. We did have a fairly large number of participants, about 240. And the GIPRA was conducted by the same staff, and it is a standardized and validated measure. Some of our limitations were lack of a comparison group. All of the GIPRA measure relies only on client self-report. And our evaluation was conducted by internal staff. And then, as I mentioned before, the inclusion of RBHA as a treatment provider in the self-help grouping. We do have some future evaluation plans. We'd like to combine GIPRA data with other available data sources in the agency and kind of see what we see there. We'd like to further examine the three pillars database to examine potential demographic predictors of client success. We'd also like to examine GIPRA data from multiple programs across the agency, as well as cross-site. And so just briefly, you can see that from our results, we weren't really able to identify a direct link between a client's participation in this program in terms of social connectedness and specific recovery outcomes. We saw that attendance in self-help groups was not significantly impacted by age, race, gender, or by frequency of substance use, but we were pleased to see that individuals who screened positive for social connectedness at intake were reporting less depression, as well as a significant increase in self-help group participation between intake and 6 months. And that's all I have for you today.
I want to thank all our presenters. I think from these presentations, there's a robust representation of health services research here in this particular area that's going to be important in the future. Now, I'd like to ask each of our four panelists to come up and sit here. And we have a substantial amount of time for question and answers from the audience. And I want to thank the audience for holding the questions to the very end. And start with the person in the very back there. You had a question earlier. I guess, while on that, just a clarification, the control group had a counselor, some counseling in it,
yes,
correct?
At the treatment facility, yes.
Right. And I noticed one of the outcomes, or maybe it was a comment, was that the people in the treatment group were appreciative that they had somebody to talk to on a regular basis, something that I thought would occur through the counseling process. Were you surprised by that result?
I think one of the big things, too, was that in the treatment group, the actual case management continued for a whole year, So the actual residential program was only for up to 120 days. So the case managers actually continued to work with the women in the treatment group for a whole, you know, year total. So they had a lot more support going on in the treatment group than in the control group.
We always ask this question in the government and paying for these services. Was there a ratio between patients to counsel, to case managers?
I want to say there were about 8 or 9 patients to case managers.
8 or 9 patients per case manager. That's good. Yes.
In those that provide case management, and I know this varies by state, how do you distinguish between the case management services and those that are provided by a counselor, unless it's the same person? Do the patients have, or clients have, separate counselors from the case manager?
In our study, yes, we have specific case managers that were there for the treatment group. So the counselors employed by the residential treatment facility were different than the counselors for the treatment group.
So. I would just add in the Massachusetts system, it's really the case management is not in the residential system, not billed as a separate service, and so providers can, depending on their staffing pattern, have a separate case manager or combined counseling and case management.
Yes, ma'am.
I had a question about both the your research paper about the case management and the research about the social connectedness. Are they available online?
Ours is not, but we'd be glad to give you more information about it. I can give you my email address and we can give you more information.
And about the residential program, I was wondering, are there any that, since there used to be, I used to work at but for the recovery, are there any that are specifically targeted towards seniors and such communities?
Not by official design. There is one program that has sort of evolved to serve older women, but you know, it's not designated for that. Good question.
Yes, sir.
We're trying to do follow-up on clients in Alaska, and that's a tough nut. You had 2 years of follow-up, and I just wondered what was your response rate, and then also how did you do it?
Yeah. Well, one of the big advantages, I didn't have a slide on this, but one of the big advantages of using administrative data is, you know, 100% follow-up. All right. So we didn't have to go out and find these people. In Washington, the state patrol gets data on, I don't know, weekly or monthly basis from county and local jurisdictions. That data then is fed into the, you know, the treatment system, that data system that the state maintains.
But wasn't self-reported?
No, it wasn't self-reported at all. It was all administrative data.
Yes, in the very back.
In your case management model, do you know why people got that other than they missed the appointment? Was there anything else that was different about that group?
We did statistical analyses to compare the groups, and we didn't find any differences on that level. But one of the theories was that as the women became more attached to their case managers, it actually was almost shameful for them if they had a relapse, and the
Yes, ma'am, in the very back.
Upfront investment for the promise of long-term cost saving. And in my experience, that's always a risky bet, especially in this day and age. But nonetheless, I think that unless you have these kind of data, then you can't even begin to have a conversation, because what they will pay attention to is some kind of positive return on their investment, and that's just the way it is. They care less, unfortunately, about quality of life and other more intangible outcomes that are associated with treatment.
Yes, sir.
It seems like another factor that's really tied in with all this is housing. So I'm wondering if, in addition to tracking criminal subsequent arrests and offenses and employment, if you would be tracking housing for these individuals that seek that treatment.
Yeah, good question. The short answer is no. We don't have any way that I know of. That's a real good question, actually, of tracking changes on an ongoing basis in housing arrangements. But that also could be, an important marker for stability and progress toward recovery.
It's not one of the GIPRA things. Homelessness is not one of the GIPRA.
It is.
It is?
Yeah, it is. Housing, yeah. And it's reported as housed or not housed, and there are various options.
Okay.
We didn't look at that specifically for today, but that's something that we can always go back and look at.
Great. So there are some ways of capturing that in some of the publicly, or federal government funded things. So, yeah. I guess I had a question for Jane, I guess. You put a slide up about the issue of people who are on medication-assisted treatment who need a residential stay. And when I worked for the Center for Substance Abuse Treatment, regulating that part of the treatment world, it would always come up this flat out across the land that if you're a methadone patient or a buprenorphine patient, need residential treatment, we'd rather not even discuss it. Pardon me? And I would pick up the phone and try to encourage residential programs, and some of which were state-supported in Virginia and other places, to think about that in a little bit more detail. And I'm wondering if your focus groups, I know they identified it as a factor, but I must have missed whether, in going forward, there would be any sort of recommendations for changing that, for making it easier and recognizing that it does interfere with treatment if someone has to come off stable medication-assisted treatment to go into a residential episode.
Well, there are a number of factors in that. Yes, we found just the bias that, if you're on methadone, you're not sober, both among providers and among consumers. In fact, in one focus group, it was referred to as drug replacement therapy. But BSAS has really addressed this issue in a number of ways. We are seeing some improvement. New regulations prohibit denial of admission on the basis of any medication. It's maybe a little difficult to enforce all the time because you can't measure what didn't happen. Hard to measure what didn't happen. But we have issued what we call practice guidances, which are sub-regulatory policy statements about how best to integrate medication into behavioral treatment. Among the recommendations are to ease the process of getting exceptions to take-home limitations, which you have to get dosed daily early in recovery, and some additional training related to opioid overdose prevention, recognition, and prevention, really addressing the importance and the success of medication-assisted treatment. The progress has been uneven in the system, but BSS is addressing it in a number of different ways. There remains that prejudice on houses that label themselves as abstinence only. But I think the policy and position of BSS is clear, and I do think that we're making some progress.
Good. Great. I guess I had one more quick question for you, Jane, and that's, looking at the you undertook this initiative and developed the focus groups to look into residential treatment in the Boston or the state of Massachusetts?
Mm-hmm. Or
the state. And I guess I'm wondering, what was the call for that? What was the need? Was it residential services were, there was an inadequate amount, services were uneven, or, I'm just wondering what prompted the extensive review?
Well, basically it was seen as an opportunity to think about, so the contract was expiring, it was an opportunity to think about should we change anything, should we improve anything. And although we undertook a much greater public input process than was required, the law did require a public input process. And, part of the result of that whole process is also a buy-in to some of the things we propose, for instance, the clinical supervisor, and also a participation by consumers. We really wanted to hear what they had to say. And they did tell us, and they appreciated having that opportunity, and they came back to the forum to say that. So that was very heartening. But basically, it was an opportunity, and it was leadership at the Bureau of Substance Abuse Services to establish a very transparent and participatory process. Nobody made us.
Good. Any more questions from the audience? Yes, sir.
I just wonder, are there going to be studies or thoughts about moving substance abuse back into primary care, especially with the Affordable Care Act as it's rolling out?
Question is moving substance abuse treatment into a...
More like a chronic condition and treating it through primary care physicians, primary care providers, as opposed to treating it as an acute, or maintenance kind of issue.
So moving substance abuse treatment into primary care settings.
For the actual treatment, so continue an ongoing treatment that the primary care takes over and does medications, does reverse behavioral management, PD, mental health, etc. I'm just curious.
Yeah. Anybody on the panel? I know from my experience at the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, they created a whole project just to integrate behavioral health care into primary care treatment.
Right.
And they developed an institute for that and brought in the mental health services people and the substance abuse treatment people to try to get that integrated into behavioral health settings, community health centers, you name it. So it was recognition that that needs to be done, that there needs to be some work there. So there are things being done to do that. There's some grants to explore that, evaluate that, look at best practices and innovations to try to get the substance abuse treatment integrated into behavioral health, into primary care settings as part of a behavioral health integration project.
Are you going to include substance abuse? No, in Massachusetts, we have been part of a behavioral health integrated care instituting effort and screening for depression in primary care. And then having integrated care managers meet with the patients and be a link between the providers and have consulting psychiatrists to try to do, I would say, more like a garden variety level of substance use treatment. For people who are using at risky levels, who may not necessarily be dependent. Some health systems have. Like Cambridge Health System and Boston Medical Center, they do have addiction services integrated into their programs. And I don't know if anyone from BU wants to comment on that.
I was just going to say, too, that patients are in the whole initiative for trying to work hard to make sure that effort is represented in the initiative and giving people the tools to address substance use while they're thinking about integrating behavioral health into primary care. So we're trying to make sure that.
I'm a family medicine physician, and I work with a general qualified health center district, and we do treat patients who've been addicted to heroin, and I prescribe about telecommunications. We
Good discussion. You might look back. You mentioned buprenorphine treatment, that the whole law that changed in 2000 to allow physicians to prescribe that in an office-based setting. An office-based, to me, is another word for primary care setting. So there's some initiatives to move in that direction. So the next step is to evaluate those initiatives, I guess, see how well they're doing. Yeah, so it's going to be a while before full integration occurs, I think. Well, I want to thank our panelists. I think this was all excellent. We have a great body of research on treatment works, and there are some identified ways to enhance treatment, and I hope everybody takes that home to their different communities. Thank you all very much, and thanks to our presenters.